wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome to the Signal to Noise podcast on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. How is that, Kyle? You're laughing at it.
I fucking love it. I miss you so much, Michael. Sometimes I miss you so much, and then you come back, and that was a smile of me missing you, bro.
Oh man, I'm glad to see your face. We have the whole gang in the house tonight. We have what? Kyle Chernside himself. The senior member. We have
ARP member.
Yeah, Chris Leonard in a very nice looking hoodie. Hello, yes. Chris.
How's it going?
Yes. Sorry. Okay. And we have Sam Boone. Hello, Sam Boone.
Hi. Quarantined.
And we have had episodes where we've had multiple Michaels. We've had multiple Kyles. We've had multiple Chris's. Pretty sure this is our first multiple Sams. If I remember correctly. So, Sam, you will be Samuel tonight. And our guest this
week is... No, not you,
is,
Sam. No, she'll be Samuel.
And our guest is my dear friend Sam Fine, who's joining us. I think the first guest to join us from an anechoic chamber that we've had. This is the first.
Live from the anechoic chamber, except not really. Live for you guys.
I can see his head breathing because it's so quiet in there. It's better than hearing me breathe.
Chris, do our shout outs real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to give a special shout out and thanks to Alan and Heath. Again, I'll say they won a Pernelli for the Avantis out at NAMM, which was kind of cool and seeing all of them. So special thanks to Alan and Heath crew.
And they're all very nice. They're all nice people.
And then RCF as well, who make great speaker products.
And they're handsome and nice.
They are handsome. Well.
Speaking of handsome, Tark. So I don't know if you want to say anything about this, but like, so apparently a picture that Michael had posted to or texted us. I don't know if it was on Discord or not. I can't remember. Keep track of this.
No, it was. So Bob McCarthy plays in a classic rock cover band, which he plays guitar and he's awesome, by the way. He's so
tell
good.
Me they like, did all Steely Dan, dude, or they did Sound dude, Guy cover tunes.
So good, man. They're like way better than I would like even think giving him a benefit of the doubt. He's like awesome. He shreds. And his band played out a gig. And apparently Tark was the person mixing. And, sick. And Tark didn't recognize Bob, and he went over and they were talking about speakers, and he said, "What's your last name?" And Bob said, "Oh, it's McCarthy." And so he said, "Oh, small world." So they sent me a selfie together, and they looked very happy. So that was very funny.
Weren't actually at that.
I was not. No, Bob sent me that. But I have seen
what
Bob's,
a random fucking dude, thing, right?
I know. Yeah, absolutely. So there you have it.
Speaking of other folks, it's a mental health awareness month, and our friends over at the clinic are doing a lot of work. There's a lot of things going into their social media. I just talked to Paul yesterday, didn't I? Yeah, I did. Mm. He's in rehearsals with the one, the only Madonna.
Yes, that's right.
Which is crazy. I mean, I kind of want to mix. I definitely have like a bunch of albums back here, and I could whip out Ray of Light and probably all the 10-inch singles. In arm's reach, if we're playing arm's reach. If we are, I'll grab one.
Let's do it. Go ahead. Go ahead. Sam's in a fucking anechoic chamber. He doesn't got shit.
The chamber is within arm's reach.
Well, that is pretty
frankly,
cool.
No,
that
the chamber is not within arm's reach. The coolest thing in arm's reach is actually the microphone above me, which the people on screen can see on camera. But
what is that?
What is that?
Not
a shotgun.
Shotgun.
That is the same shotgun microphone that is used as sort of the famous shotgun microphone on all of the Tiny Desk concerts.
Oh.
Yo, that's so cool.
Is that what we're hearing you talk on right now?
Yes, that is, except you're only hearing me on the mid capsule. It's actually a mid-side shotgun microphone.
All right, so just to avoid all the emails that we'll get otherwise, tell us the model number of that thing, because people are going to want to know.
We're going to have the model number and maybe a brief explanation of the mid-side thing, so that doesn't also
sure,
follow
so.
In.
This is an MKH-418-S from Sennheiser. It is their sort of bog standard normal shotgun microphone for the mid element. I think that's the 4 17? I actually don't remember. And then it has an extra little figure eight capsule in the back pointing sideways. And then it breaks out into two cables that come down to your audio interface. You have to feed both sides phantom power, otherwise it gets unhappy, even if you're only using one. That's and then neat. you can in post make things more or less stereo.
More or less stereo.
I like that. That's interesting. I've never worked with the stereo shotguns before. That's super interesting, though.
Well, how about it's not a shotgun. I'll say that, like the VP88 would be the closest thing. Like that's
yeah,
but it's not the same. I know it's not the same thing. Don't send the emails.
Oh, there it is. What is that, Kyle? What?
This is Madonna's retrospective version 3, the 7-inch singles. It came in a little collectible thing. I love Madonna. I'm not going to kid you. Everyone saw last week that if anyone wants to start a Depeche Mode cover band, I am in. That's all I got to say. I can't do Madonna very well, but I can fake Depeche Mode. This thing's dope, though.
Can you at least get the cone boobs? Can you wear them at least?
I already have a set. Okay,
cool. Samuel, coolest thing in arm's reach.
I have this coffee cup that's got like a carabiner like screwed in and built to the side of it. It's like stainless steel and pretty indestructible. So it's my new.
Oh, look at that. Oh, it's a carabiner coffee cup. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. See. Yeah, it's
so like you can clip it onto the side of the camel after the nuclear wasteland passes. Yeah, exactly. And you're all living off of purpose yeah, for living
does,
off the
does
land.
Your elephant have a. Yeah. Yeah, never mind.
All the riggers in the UK will have that on their utilikilt.
Yo, the utilikilts are cool, man.
With underwear. Yes, they are. They're okay.
Chris?
Well, I mean, if you're a rigger, you sort of have to.
Yeah, you have to wear underwear.
I don't know. I guess maybe the stack of stickers that I'm about to send Jason.
Train.
Jason Moore from Train is like, yo, we need some more stickers so I can distribute them across the venues across the country. So if you see a single to noise sticker on a power distro or a front of house or something like that across the country, good chances are it's from Jason Moore.
Yes. Or me.
And shout out to my friends who have been sending me pictures of all of them over the past month as we've all been.
I got one the other day. Like my buddy Billy Martin texted me and he was like, is a picture of a power disher. So actually it was in Phoenix. So maybe it was you, Kyle. I don't know who it was.
Oh yeah, that was me. The one in Phoenix was me.
I love it.
I have a card, and maybe we can speak about this on a future episode, but Kyle Jensen and I finished our run of Rent at Hamilton College a couple of weeks ago. And I went from there immediately out to some other gigs and NAMM and stuff. And when I came back, there was a card. This card has been signed by every single member of the cast and crew. There's a ton of them. There's like 40 names on here.
Look how small they had to write.
Yeah. And they're not just like generic thank yous. Like they're very thoughtful little notes in here from all the students. And it's like, it's really, really sweet. So I really appreciated that. So that's the coolest thing I have when I was reach.
I'd love to talk to that in a future episode. That'd be fun.
Yeah, we had a great time. And we should get Kyle on. And we had a blast, man. We really did. And I was honestly very proud of the show. I thought it was a great, I mean, like they had some insane talent. They had a lot of really good singers and a really good band. And I've been to professional theater productions that didn't have that good of a sound and that good of singing, and very proud of it. And I think it came out great. So yeah, we should talk about that.
It's kind of like tribute bands.
Yes. So
one last housekeeping, and then we can get into all the nerdery that's about to happen.
Nerdery.
So we have had a tremendous influx of people join our Discord recently, and Facebook as well. And I just want to say it's pretty cool. Because a lot of people are relatively new to either the podcast or the industry and stuff like that. It's a very safe space and they're already seeing that. The other thing that I find fascinating is the people who talk about, like they're just recently finding about the podcast and they're like, I have to start at one and work my way up. And
oh, don't do it. Don't fucking do that.
But there's a couple people who are like dedicated to like, no, I will not listen to the new episodes until I get all the way through. And I'm like, you don't have to do that. They're like, my brain won't let me. Anyway, that's some.
Yeah, it's not the Mandalorian. You're not going to miss anything.
I know. It's fine. It's some insane dedication for people who have been saying they're doing that. And I appreciate it. But again, I'm trying to relieve your mind. You don't. They might not hear this until a year later. But if you're listening to this now, don't feel guilty about not going back and listening to things in order.
then shout out to my friend Father John Downey from LA. Yes. He's the dude who mixes some symphony stuff out there in orchestra. He's one of the people that texts me and was like, dude, I'm only on episode 89, and he'll call me and tell me jokes that we cracked back then, and I'm like, why did I even say that? What prompted me? Yeah, guys, thanks for listening. We're almost up to 10K in Facebook, and we've just now started getting spam. So if you see it,
report it. That's how you know you made it, when you get the spam bots coming in. Yeah,
it's awesome. Someone was selling chickens and one of those little trucks from India. It was crazy. I can say that.
Yeah.
Is there like a cat being strangled outside your house, or what am I
Dude,
hearing?
Dude, that's my parrot, that? Bro.
That's hilarious. I forgot you got a parrot.
It's Kemper's parrot.
Hold on, the irony of all these years of Michael's parrot kind of chirping in during episodes, and now Kyle has a parrot.
That is a vocal bird. Holy cow.
That thing's doing.
I have a 35 to 40-year-old Amazon parrot that we adopted, and he is nuts. His name is Jolly Roger. Yeah.
You should have gone Sam's route. Her adoptions, you don't ever see them. You just basically send money away to those animals. You never actually see them.
Look, sorry, let me support the Wildlife Foundation. Let me save the elephants.
So, Sam, you are currently an audio systems engineer at Sonos. You made a pretty badass subwoofer that I want to talk about, but you've also been in the past with Community. You've been with Biamp. You spent some time at Fulcrum. You really get around, dude. You've done a lot of cool stuff. You have more cool shit in your house, I think, than anybody I've ever met. And you are sort of my go-to guy whenever I'm trying to do something nerdy with lab equipment and I can't make it work, and you let me borrow your laser tubes and stuff. So that's my introduction to Sam. Sam, thank you for coming on the show, dude. Yay. It's good to see you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
So I think I want to start with this idea of scale, whereas we are working in, you know, the pro audio, the live audio world, and you know, if somebody makes a vocal microphone that sells 10,000 units, that's an enormously successful unit. And you're just from a totally different context, the consumer audio world. You're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of units as a successful product. And so you can do cool things when you're working on that scale that we just can't even start to think about in live audio. And so can you talk about transitioning into that sort of market from where you came from?
Absolutely. I think, as you said, I got super lucky getting into sound in general, and I started my career in live sound, both as a live sound tech doing actual shows and then eventually designing speakers and working for companies doing that. It's interesting to talk about the difference between what I was doing when I was at Community or at Fulcrum and what I'm doing now, because in a lot of ways, it's the exact same thing. All of the same fundamentals apply. But you definitely have a different set of design constraints, right? You know, at Community or Fulcrum, if you had to add an extra $10 to the bill of materials cost for a product, yeah, you'd look at it a little bit, but you'd be like, yeah, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's not that much. At Sonos, if you had to add an extra 25 cents, you know, to the bill of materials for a product, you start to really look at it and say, do we really need that? Because at the end of the day, we're talking completely different price points, completely different style products. And like you said, some of the products we make millions of a year. And so our customers, they buy our stuff because it's good, but they also buy our stuff because they can afford it, right? And it's important to make sure as we're designing that we're making smart choices. We're not sacrificing audio quality. But by the same token, we're not putting in like extravagant niceties that we really don't need.
So your job title officially is systems engineer.
Yes, my job title is officially audio systems engineer, which I find to be awesome.
So can we talk about what that actually means? Because in my mind, when you say that, I think about more of things on the lines where Michael and I do, where, you know, we're using smart and we're running around an arena usually, and it has something to do with a large format line array. And that is not at all what you do at Sonos.
Yeah, that's a good characterization. At Sonos, I'm using smart and I'm running around a large format listening room. I think that you could really characterize what I and what my coworkers with the same sort of job title do as in many ways the same sort of thing that you do, but from a manufacturer's perspective. This is true at Sonos as it would be at any other, you know, speaker company. we're still in charge of tuning the speakers, right? It is still our job to do the final voicing on the speakers, but it's also our job to actually be sort of the traditional speaker designer, right? At the beginning of a project, we start with something we call the sound experience brief. We craft this. This is a document that's written in plain English. You know, basically anyone off the street with any knowledge of sound could read it and be like, I know what the speaker is supposed to be and approximately what it's supposed to sound like. Then what we do is we take that and we try to turn it into a set of actual specs. You know, well, how many dB is loud enough, right? The sound experience brief might say,
all the dBs and spells.
Pretty much. I'll give you a quick example that I think is kind of cool. When we did the Move speaker, the Sonos Move, it was the first speaker Sonos had done that was really intended to be a portable speaker and intended to be used outside. And we had to decide, well, how loud does it need to get? And the metric we ended up settling on, and this was written sort of into that sound experience brief, is this speaker should get loud enough that if you're in your backyard at a like picnic table and you have it just on the picnic table, you would worry at its loudest setting that you'd be annoying your neighbors. And that's sort of like, we said, okay, yeah, that seems like a good metric, right? And then we had to go back and figure out, what was it?
Who is we that said that that was a good metric?
Scientific.
Well, I wasn't here at the time.
Okay.
But it was it very was the scientific. Folks that work on my team.
There was a hypothesis. But then
we had to, yes. We had to take that and be like, well, how loud is loud enough that you as a person might worry about, you know, disturbing the neighbors? So we took a speaker outside, put it on a picnic table, had people gather on the table and turned it up until we were like, yeah, that feels about right for this. And then we measured it and we said, okay, this thing needs to get just a little bit louder than this, and we know that's loud enough. We'll take the things that we have in very sort of flowery, normal human terms and turn them into hard specs. And then we get to sort of deliver on those specs. So we say it needs to get this loud and it needs to go this low in bass, right? And it needs to have this sort of stereo image. And then we get to figure out how to actually do that. And sometimes that's easy and sometimes that really isn't. So that's the second part of our job. And it's probably the part that most people think of when they think of like a speaker designer. We sit down, we do like the low frequency modeling, we do the high frequency modeling, we do all of that sort of stuff in the computer. But at the same time, we're also building prototypes. And the prototypes, you know, they're really ugly. They don't look anything like the final speaker. They can be way bigger than the final speaker. Like a, you know, one of my coworkers likes to say that if we could get a whole bunch of like rubber chickens and make them squawk in unison in a way that sounds just like what the final speaker is supposed to sound like, that would be good enough.
I do that,
you know, our sound experience prototype.
When I go, like, we go to like Walmart or Target with like my kids, and I go down the toy aisle, it's a competition to see how many of the noise making things I can make go off in unison. So like, if there's like a bunch of like Elmos, like a Tickle Me Elmos or something like that, or whatever.
They
like
still sell the Tickle Me Elmo,
or just one of those things. Yes. Right? So like, I'll line them up. And I'll see how many fingers I can get, how many at one time, and try to set them off all at the same time and get them off. So I do that actually when I'm in the store. That's how I amuse myself.
Right. You could work at Sonos.
Cool. Sweet.
So we'll do this. We'll come up with sound experience, you know, sort of prototype. We'll have a lot of people within our company, mostly the folks on my team, but also folks outside of my team, listen to the prototype and say, hey, does this sound like something we think is what the product should sound like? Is this acceptable? And then we go and we work with the other teams, the mechanical engineering team, the industrial design team, all of these other teams to actually build this thing. You know, I like to tell people that we're not like transducer designers on my team. We have a team that does that, but we are specifying what the transducer needs to do. That's to say, like, we don't say how many turns of wire go on the voice coil or what the exact, you know, like material that you make the cone out of is. We have a team of folks to do that, but we are saying, hey, we need a transducer with these parameters that's going to survive this, that's going to be able to move this far, you know, linearly. Then we go, we wrap that together. We spend a lot of time iterating on sort of things that start to look more and more like the final product until we get towards the end. And all along, we've been doing measurements. You know, this anechoic chamber doesn't just sit here to look pretty. We actually normally use this to measure speakers rather than do podcasts. and towards the end of the program, we've gone all along like building digital signal processing, like systems to make our speakers do what we need to do, building in the EQs, building in the limiters, building in all of that stuff. And at the end of the program, it's our job to finalize all of that, make sure it sounds exactly how we want it to. we sort of take this, we all listen to it internally, but we also go out to what we call our soundboard, which is a group of, we call them creators, but it's like studio mix engineers from various fields that are all like Grammy Award winners, essentially. We bring them the speakers before they're released. We have them listen and we get their feedback. And we do this actually pretty early on, but all the way through till the end. And we take their feedback really seriously. Like when I first came here, I thought that was just like a marketing stunt. I've sat in on some of these listening sessions now. It's not a marketing stunt at all. Like they give us feedback and they're like, you know, that center image is a bit wonky on that thing. And then we go back and we do a month of work to figure out what was wrong and fix it.
Wow.
You know, once we are pretty sure that we've got something we really like and it's coming to the end of the program in general, we check it all in. And the product actually ends up on store shelves and we get to feel really proud about it.
I got a lot of questions.
I do too now.
All right, two. One, and I know this is a longer conversation, but what's the average life cycle that it would take from we're going to start this new design thing to it being on the shelf?
Yeah, that's tricky because it's different for every company, and it's even different for every program within Sonos. You know, in general, we shoot for a couple years. At the end of the day, whether or not we hit that is tricky. You know, there's definitely products that have gone way longer than we probably were aiming for. And there's other products that end up being relatively easy to develop and actually end up hitting the targets exactly how we want. At other companies I've worked for, it really depends on the size of your team, what you think you can do, and if you're biting off more than you can chew or not.
Because okay. And then without going on a rabbit trail there, you said initially you maybe the box size or whatever is ugly or not the size that you're going to be, but certainly the housing and all of that has to play into a factor of the sonic quality and what it does and all that. So where's the differentiation of just what the transducers are doing versus what the orientation of them are within that box and the sizing of that box and all that stuff?
Yeah, so that's where the systems comes in, the audio systems engineer, because in my role, we're like taking all of the individual piece parts, right? All of those individual disciplines and shoving them together and trying to make the trade-offs of like, well, we could have a bigger box and be more efficient. So maybe we need a smaller amplifier and a smaller battery, but then that's not going to work out well for the industrial design team. So we have to like rejigger this here and, you know, where is the sound experience that we're aiming for? Like, you know, how critical is it that we get exactly this loud or exactly this frequency? Because, you know, that can save a ton of battery life. I think that doesn't answer your question exactly. But when you're talking about things like transducers versus how speakers are aimed in the box, the transducers are, at the end of the day, where the sound comes from. They're sort of the heart of the sound. It's really critical that you don't mess up the transducer. But how the final product sounds, specifically how spacious it sounds, if you have something that's meant to have like a stereo image or an immersive image, that largely comes from sort of your waveguide design, how you orient the transducers in the box. If you chose wisely on your transducer selection, so you can make sure that the things are aiming out, you know, have the frequency response that you really want them to produce the image that you're going for. And then that also all ties in potentially even more to the industrial design, right? You know, we can make speakers that look good and sound good, and that's what we aim to do. We could make speakers that, you know, look super duper ugly and sound a bit better, but we choose to strike a good balance in making a good product. And I would say that to qualify that, we care a lot about what our stuff sounds like, but if something is going to be just like some funky shape that you're not going to be able to lug around in a portable speaker, that ruins the idea of it being a portable speaker, right? And so within the products category, we need to make sure that we're doing the best we can with the audio.
Insane. So my question is going to be more in general. So listening to you speak about this, obviously you've learned a ton about how the Sonos thing works. Now you've been with other manufacturers, done more loudspeaker work. I assume you're from Massachusetts. And then I go and I look at some stuff. You're in Massachusetts, correct?
I am in Boston right now, yes.
So what's the deal with Massachusetts being like this loudspeaker mecca of the United States? And did that lead you into this business of loudspeakers? Obviously, you started with live sound, so EAW was probably this thing that was just in every venue ever you walked into, correct? Let's go back. Take us back, Sam.
I will take you back to my childhood where I grew up in Houston, Texas.
Oh, home of the mosquito. Never mind.
Yes, home of the mosquito and the very hot, humid day. And then I went to school in Rochester, New York, which is surprisingly enough for like a little city sort of in the middle of nowhere-ish. Rochester has a pretty thriving audio business. Rochester has Ashley. They have Whirlwind. They
also
have
where
actually,
Sound Image got started.
Isn't Macintosh out there?
They might be. I actually don't remember.
I think it's outside of Rochester. Yeah. But you're right. Like that whole
Whirlwind mm-hmm. is in Rochester.
That whole part of New England is just like saturated with great audio things that happen. No matter if you like those brands or not.
You're asking for emails there and lumping Rochester to New England.
I know. Yeah.
Well, whatever. It's the Northeast. Like the state, you could drive across the state in like 3 minutes.
Yeah,
give
me
a break. It's like a big county.
You're not wrong.
I mean, you're not entirely wrong. But 3 minutes is a little optimistic. But you know.
You all sound the same. There we go. Now I'm going to get emails. Hey, I don't sound like that. Hey, our piece is way different.
You know, the water down in Philly tastes way different than the water.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
All right. I think what Kyle was trying to get at is how did you get into speaker manufacturing as opposed to doing live
sound? And so I had started live sound back in Houston. When I went to school, I decided I was going to go and try to get like a slightly more traditional engineering degree. I was interning during high school with a live sound company in the Houston area. I saw how ridiculously hard my boss was working, pulling like all nighters. He was like in his 50s. And I'm like, when I'm in my 50s, I don't really want to have to do that. So let me go see if I can design mixing consoles or something. So I ended up jumping into electrical engineering as my like sort of degree path. And as it turns out, that's actually a really good choice, but not necessarily if you want to design mixing consoles, because nobody actually designs analog mixing consoles today. These days you want to, you know, a computer science degree for that. But, went to school, Rochester, New York, in part because it was one of the better schools I got into, RIT, and in part because it was in a nice place that got cold instead of very hot, though it turns out Rochester also gets very warm in the summer. While I was at school, I had the wonderful opportunity to go down and visit Fulcrum Acoustics' sales office, which is inexplicably in Rochester instead of in you know, the Boston area. And while I was there, I was looking for an internship, a co-op type thing. And I asked them and they're like, well, you know, maybe I think we might be looking for some engineering help. And I ended up seeing Dave Gunness at the AES show just a few months later. And I chatted with him for a bit. And he's like, you know what? Why don't you come out and, you know, talk to us? And they ended up offering me a co-op there, which was an amazing stroke of luck to get to learn with those guys. Was there for about 6 months during my second to last year of college. Went through the last year of college, graduated. They were still a really small company at the time, and they had just hired an engineer, so they didn't need another one. And I was like, oh, well, that's a shame, because I loved working for them. But ended up landing a job at Community Professional Loudspeakers in Philly. And I was there for just under 3 years. We got bought by Biamp. And that was going reasonably well. But I was like, you know, it might be time to look around and see if it's time to make a change. I've been here for 3 years. That feels like the right amount of time to start to see, hey, is this what I want to be doing forever right here with this company? And right around that time, one of the folks that had been at Community as well had left, and he had landed at Sonos, which he had spoken pretty highly of even before I knew he came here, as a place to work. And I chatted with him, and I was like, yeah, how do you like it there? And he really loved it. So they had an opening. I applied to it. They got back to me a few months later, and long story short, I landed at Sonos at a very convenient time, because I moved to Sonos and moved to the Boston area during the first week that everything shut down for the pandemic.
Wonderful.
So that was a terrible move to try to pull off, because my moving truck got stuck for like a month with nobody able to help me like unload it. But I did land at a company that ended up surviving the pandemic a bit better than most of the folks in the pro audio world. And it is a company that, beyond that, you know, I really have fallen in love with. Working for Sonos has been great, both from the people I get to work with, the company culture, and also just like the amazing facilities that we get to use just to build speakers. Like, we didn't have one of these at either of the other companies I've worked for as I stand here in the Sanecoic chamber.
One thing that comes up a lot in our Discord is people who are interested in like the kind of nitty gritty of loudspeaker design. And I am, you know, sort of willfully ignorant of that. I like to say that my job, you know, it's not my job to make the good speaker that sounds, you know, the manufacturer makes it speaker that does something. And my job is to figure out what to do with that speaker. So I immediately go, I don't know. I throw my hands up. I don't really know a lot about loudspeaker design. And I usually tell people to go talk to you. But I mean, it seems like there's not a lot of amazing resources on loudspeaker design in terms of a modern pro audio context. Like, can you talk about that? Or maybe if I'm sure there's some people listening who want to know about that. Like, where should they look? How did you learn all these things?
Yeah, unfortunately, you're not wrong. A lot of what I learned on the job.
Careful, Michael knows that.
which is sad, because like ideally there would be like a spot you could go to learn this. I will say that there are a few good like pure acoustics programs both in the US and abroad, like that are like master's degrees in acoustics if that's what you want to do. Like there's one that I know a bunch of people both currently in and already graduated, which is the Penn State program. And most of the people that go through that program end up doing like sonar for the military. But a fair number of them either were and end up back at or end up at sort of speaker and other acoustics engineering companies. In terms of just like relatively low barrier to entry resources, there are tons of books and such. There's tons of AES papers. But the problem that I found there is there's very few that actually talk about sort of the modern way you design a loudspeaker. It's not really the 70s anymore, right? We're not designing something anticipating that it will be put onto an amplifier that just has a relatively flat frequency response curve. These days, we're designing for things that have DSP in the chain. And beyond that, we're designing things for amplifiers that in the pro world have like tons of power available. Like you're generally limiting yourself with the speaker, not the amp, depending on where you are. And it's a little interesting because at Sonos, you know, and I'll talk about this a little more if you want me to in a few minutes, but like in some ways we're light years ahead of what the pro audio companies are doing. And in some ways we're actually leaning back into the past and putting more value back into these like TL small parameters and such that most pro audio companies at this point are just ignoring, because if you have enough voltage headroom and like power coming from your amplifier, you can generally ignore that stuff. So in any case, to answer your question a little more concisely, I don't have a really good set of resources just to hand you. I don't have like a book that I have found that I'm like, read this and you'll know what you're doing and it will be great. I will say there is a relatively good blog that I found. It's called Audio Judgment, I want to say. I have no affiliation with it, but I've been impressed with the content on there. And the person who runs it does have an online class that it doesn't seem to be too expensive that you can pay for. I have never actually bothered to pay for it, to take it myself just to be able to recommend it. But I did just find somebody who actually has paid for it but hasn't finished it. So I've asked them to let me know how it is. If you're in the Boston area, I've started teaching speaker classes out of one of the local makerspaces here. That's which awesome. I'm hoping I can eventually turn into like recorded sessions that can then be, you know, free for people to actually use. But, you know, this is my first time going through trying to teach in a semi-formal setting. And so I'm not putting too much pressure on myself to get it perfect the first time.
Well, Salmon, we've talked a bit about this because I called you up and said, hey, you know, I know my job technically starts 1 foot in front of the speaker, but I kind of want to understand what's going on in here.
Yeah, don't listen too much to Michael.
See? And so,
wow.
Anyways, can we talk a little bit more about learning through projects? Because that's something you and I have talked a great deal about. And it's also part of what makes your house a wonderland.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the listeners at home who have not met me and have not had the chance to stop by my house, I don't just do speakers, right? That's my job and I love it and I love audio, but I'm sort of a maker at heart. I love making things. I love doing projects because at the end of the day, not only do I end up with something cool, I learn a ton about it while I'm building it. And so my philosophy personally has always been just learning through doing things, doing projects. And when I do this, I often end up spending more money by a fair margin than I would have spent on just like buying something. You know, it seems like it'll be cheaper up front until you realize you need to buy all the tools to do it. And then you're going to mess up a whole bunch because you don't know what you're doing. And then eventually, once you know what you're doing, you're like, well, I guess it's great that I learned that, but that cost three times as much as what it would have cost otherwise. About a year and a half ago, I decided I was going to try to build my own in-ear monitors from scratch.
Interesting.
And I did. And there is a little post on my website, Sam Fine, Fine spelled weird, FEINE.com, if you're interested. And that is documenting what I did to build those. And really what I probably should have done is gone out and bought like the top of the line one from JH, the top of the line one from Universal Ears, and the top of the line one from, you know, take your pick of the rest of the folks. And it still would have probably cost less than me building my own like reasonably good, but not top of the line set of in-ear monitors. But I know how to do it now. And that's the sort of skill set that is not directly relevant to what I'm doing at work. I'm working on speakers that play loud, you know, not speakers that go on your head or in your ears. But it certainly taught me a ton, both about that and also about what you can do with little tiny speaker drivers.
Right, and I think
I just clicked on the link of your describing making your in ears. That's freaking fascinating. I'm sorry. Like to make your own custom mold. Like these aren't just like generic tips. Like, these are full on custom.
I went to an audiologist and got some molds made.
That's insane.
So that's insane. But you made a robotic couch too. And I think if I don't say it, nobody's gonna say it. Fuck yeah, bro! You made a couch.
I think with the best a robotic part is the couch has underglow. So you know,
look at it. Dude, sick. We'll have to put that link in our stuff.
Please do. You know, it's interesting though, because like Sam, I've just talked about some of the stuff I've done. I've not actually talked about your actual question, which is like talk a bit about like the benefit of doing things as projects. And my answer to that is when you're doing something as a project, it's really easy to get excited about it because you get your hands dirty with it and you're gonna end up with something at the end, whether it works or not. You will have learned something and you will physically have something that you've built. And even if your project is code, you'll physically have the code you wrote, right? And it doesn't work for everyone, but I'm a really hands-on learner. I'm not really good just like picking up a textbook and opening it. You know, I've struggled to get through Bob's book like two or three times now. Bob McCarthy, of course, Sound System Design and Optimization. But I learn way more by actually just going and doing this stuff and picking up tips from other people along the way. And when I run into a problem, you know, I know what that problem is because I'm like super familiar with it because I ran into it myself and I can start doing the research to figure out how to get through it. And I think that's probably something that a lot of people can do. The hard part with learning through projects is projects get expensive. You know, I told you how expensive those in-ear monitors got. And yeah, I could have done it a lot cheaper if I had taken a different path, but I sort of wanted to do it the modern way that manufacturers are moving towards rather than just the old-fashioned way that would have worked, but I wouldn't have ended up with something that was quite as nice.
Well, and we chatted about it where I said, hey, I want to learn how a speaker works. And you go, well, they have these kits. And I went, that sounds like a good place to start. Because I don't know enough to go handpick parts, but I know enough to read an instruction manual and go, oh, that's what that does.
Exactly. And like, if you want to get into speakers and you just want to make something that's pretty guaranteed to sound decent, you can just go to Parts Express or take your pick of the various kit sources. Parts Express is the biggest one in the US anyway. And you can just buy one of their kits. And, you know, not to shill for them too much, I've definitely heard at least one of their kits that I was not impressed with. But things like the Overnight Sensations kit, you know, so long as it's in stock when you go to order it, it's not really that expensive for a pair of passive speakers. And they sound really good right out of the box, even with like a cheap amplifier driving them from Amazon or something. And you're not going to learn like how to pick a transducer you know, how to do the actual speaker design stuff. But you will learn, hey, this is a crossover. This is what it does. Here's how you actually glue together a speaker enclosure. And you'll get the real sense of accomplishment of actually having built these things that sound really good. And then you can jump off from there into bigger and better projects down the road.
Didn't you, Sam, you got yourself a kit, right? Did you get a kit?
Yes, I have not been home long enough to embark on this endeavor as I've been gone for the past 6 weeks straight, but I'm sort of home for 10 days, so that's my current project.
Well, there you go. All you need is some like wood glue and clamps.
Sick. I think I have both. So if not, I live close to Lowe's. It'll be great. But yeah, I took Sam's advice and have been, that is my next project. So I'm quite excited about that bit. And it's been really cool. And Sam, you're kind of, in my mind, like the king of making stuff work, right? Whatever it is, you have a million and one tools in your house.
And pizza ovens.
When I need to... Yeah. I was going to say, are we getting into that?
I mean, if you want to.
Did you make a pizza oven?
No, but I did, like, over the pandemic, one of my pandemic hobbies was going on Facebook Marketplace and eBay and Craigslist and finding like old small commercial kitchen equipment that needed to be fixed up for cheap and like taking it home and fixing it up. So I bought an old pizza oven that had sat like on the ground in a barn for a couple years and was like super rusty and gross. Took it home, like took the angle grinder to it, cleaned it all up, repainted it, and it makes great pizza. That is that's what Sam's referring to.
Did you make this laser cutter, by the way?
No, the laser cutter that's on my website. So there's an article on the website, which is like how to choose a laser cutter and what you should know about laser cutters. I do own a laser cutter. I did not make it. It was actually given to me because it was an old laser that my dad had got years ago that needed a lot of fixing, but I didn't make that from scratch. You can, if you want to, but honestly, these days, if you're going to buy a laser cutter, there's plenty that are about as inexpensive as just making it yourself.
You said that's not the point of this. You said that's not the point.
That is true. If you want to make a laser cutter, you should make a laser cutter. Just be careful.
So I have a question then. And I might have missed it because I had to step away because the bird bit my daughter. But is your house like... Yeah, she's fine.
I laughed and then asked. I'm sorry. But
it's okay. She's a child. She'll get over it. Do you have like... Do you listen to music at home all the time?
You know, I do listen to music relatively frequently. I would say that I haven't always, you know, when I was a bit younger, I didn't actually get into sound and into live sound because I was like really into music, believe it or not. Like I got into sound and live sound because I rode the school bus home with some friends that happened to live relatively close to me. And they were in a band, and one day they asked me, hey, Sam, you're sort of technical. You want to be our sound guy? And I was like, sound guy? What's that? And things snowballed from there. But I
heard that story before.
Yeah, that's the story.
I do these days deliberately sit down and say, hey, I want to relax. I'll kick back on the couch and listen to music. But I don't have some, like, million-dollar, you know, speaker system. I have
but you're not designing million-dollar speaker systems. So it behooves you to be listening to things and experiencing things the way consumers are going to consume them.
Yeah.
You know, that's true to an extent. But, like, I also don't think you need a million-dollar listening system to get really good music. Like, my system at home that I normally listen to is it's a pair of, like, Cali Audio. They're IN8, I want to say. It's like a coaxial mid-high three-way studio monitor.
That sounds
remarkably
fancy.
Inexpensive. They cost $400 a piece, you know, and then those are connected to a DSP and a couple of 18-inch subs that I built the enclosures out of a Parts Express kit and then stuffed some drivers in that I had laying around, you know. It's nothing super fancy. Yeah, it's a little bit large for a living room, but, like, it sounds great. I like it. I did a ton of tuning on it, just the same way that you might do a ton of tuning on your stereo at home with the skill set you have. Same thing. You know,
no.
And I like how it sounds.
I got a bad tower speaker that's powered, and I got these Behringer things that I listen to. But I think it's interesting because as much as I try to escape music, I'm always listening. And I worked for a loudspeaker manufacturer for a very short amount of time, and gratefully, it was Bose, and I got to meet a lot of smart individuals when it came to electronics and acoustics and the actual math and science behind it. And it was super interesting. But I found myself listening to speakers a different way when sometimes I would sit down and go, oh, and I'd go up and adjust, like I'd move, or I'd move myself, or I'd move it away from the wall, or just like little different things that I picked up at work that I took home in my listening experience. And you sitting in an anaconda chamber, like sometimes I just want to do that, man. Sometimes I don't want to listen to my fucking self, you know? And that might be a good idea too. But I'd imagine that you spend a lot of time listening to things out of speakers, whether it's spoken word or music.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And you know, for my job, one of the parts of it is that I listen to my own stuff and I listen to my coworker stuff, and I listen really critically for every little flaw that I can find so that we can try to fix it, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I want to do that, but sometimes I just want to go home and listen to an album that I like and just like sit down with a system that I feel is good enough that I'm not going to have to worry about whether what I heard was in the music or in the speaker, you know, and just relax and enjoy it.
So that leads to my actual question. Do you believe, with all the engineering background that you've had, that when you're designing a speaker, no matter who the manufacturer was, do you still get to put a little bit of your paint on it, your art on it? Does it step away from the science and the math for a second and you're like, this is the way I hear things? So it's kind of like your own little fingerprint on how it's done. And do you see other manufacturers doing that too?
I'd say yes and no, right? So like there's definitely some amount of art to this, but it's not the same level of art, at least in my opinion, as like mixing a band on stage, right? Where you're actually deciding how that ends up sounding. And in some ways though, it's actually really similar, because like if you went and mixed Metallica like they were a jazz trio, you know, people would be really upset if I went and made a Sonos speaker that sounds like it's, you know, X manufacturer here that has like a weird target curve. People would probably be upset and I'd have to change that, right? What we tend to go for here, and what we've generally gone for at every company I've worked for, is a really sort of neutral speaker, like a speaker that passes through the music that you put into it and doesn't mess it up in some way, right? There are companies that like have a whole sonic signature they go for. And I won't say that like the companies I've worked for don't have something to that effect, where all the speakers at least need to sound reasonably similar. But reasonably similar here means like we're making a speaker that just sounds correct, not we're making a speaker that has like this exact smiley face curve.
True. You know what? My observation on that is, someone who has a fantastic Sonos soundbar and the new sub now. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah.
Which Sam designed, by the way.
Yeah, we have been really conditioned to be okay with the bottom three octaves missing on all of the things we listen on. We listen on iPads, and we listen on laptops, and we listen on flat panel TVs that have shitty little tiny 1-inch drivers, and there's nothing below 80 hertz that comes out of them. And when you finally get a system together that actually has the extension, and the sub goes down to like 26 hertz or something like that, like it's got some serious extension on it. Like Sam, you heard it. Your eyes, Samuel heard it. Your eyebrows went through the roof when you heard that thing.
and I have something else to add when you're done with this, because I did a very similar thing recently at Wayne's house, where I sat on the floor for like 2 hours just listening through.
Yeah,
types of speakers.
It's remarkable how much you don't realize you're missing until you get the full spectrum back, and there's all this stuff going on. And like, I'm watching movies that I've seen a bunch, or listening to music that I've listened to a bunch, or I mean, even when you play a video game and there's a gunshot, it just has so much more like visceral impact than you remember, just because you're getting the full spectrum back. And it kind of, it's not a sonic signature of a Sonos product necessarily, but you do have a sort of knack for cramming an impressive amount of low frequency extension into these very little things. I don't know how you do it, but it really made me think about, wow, we're not really used to hearing that stuff. And it's sort of been lost, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that like bass is really the emotion, you know, bass is the emotion of the music in large part, that and the human voice, and bass is sort of the emotion in movies. If you have a movie that's an amazing movie, you're definitely going to have an easier time crying if you get those really like low frequency notes that are just like going on in the background that are meant to be there than if you don't have that and it's really just the dialogue. And we know this, right? So we try to make sure that our speakers, you know, in whatever category they are, you know, you're not going to get an ultra portable that really plays as low or as loud as like a subwoofer. We try to make sure that they have a full bodied sound, right? And we try to do that in a way that that it's not like one note that gets really loud, right? You can do a bandpass design or like some weird like overextended passive radiator thing that just sounds impressive until you start listening to a bass guitar and you're like, why is every note the same note? Oh, wait a minute, they're not supposed to be, right? And a lot of that comes back to how you do the speaker design to start with and how you do the tuning, right? You can start with a design knowing that you're going to be aiming for something that's really impressive, but you only care about one note, and you'll end up with something that's really impressive, but you only get one note. Or you can start with a design where you're aiming for something that maybe doesn't have quite the same amount of output as you could have gotten the other way, but is as smooth as you can reasonably get it, so that when you are listening to that bass guitar, that bass synthesizer, you actually hear the individual notes, and you feel them a bit, and it's not like it's all the same thing.
Can you go back to, you had mentioned earlier the difference between pro audio versus consumer audio and some of the things that maybe pro audio is either behind or ahead or, you know, whatever you were alluding to there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually that's a really good segue there, because Michael just talked about, you know, how like the Sonos speakers seem to squeeze a ridiculous amount of bass into a small space. And in fact, basically every one of our sound experience briefs circling back around says impressive bass for its size. Like that's one of the things we're going for there. And I think in layman's terms, without like talking too much about it, the way we do that is we use the full excursion of our low frequency drivers, right? We know how much we can push them. We do the testing to prove that we're not going to hurt them and they'll sound good when we push them that far. And then we design our DSP limiters such that we can push them that far at relatively low volumes. And when we turn the volume up, you know, you're not going to keep getting more bass as you turn it up. You'll get the same amount of bass and the highs and the mids will keep coming up. And we find the balance point where that's not objectionable when it's played loudly, but that works really well when it's played low. So this is how we can get, you know, a little 6 liter internal volume subwoofer with 2 6.5 inch drivers to produce a reasonably impressive amount of like 30 hertz content out of it in a home audio setting.
I really like home audio. Just going to say that. I think it is a game changer when you watch movies and things and comparing it to live audio. The open air and the space is easily engulfed. And what kind of technology do you see moving forward with home audio now? I mean, are people going smaller and lighter and more, or are they doing integrated audio in their homes? Like, what do you see more of now or moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, there's a few trends right now, right? So smaller, lighter, and the portable side, but still keeping that same amount of bass output and trying to squeeze out battery life, because you can always make something smaller if you're willing to throw more power at it to get the same amount of bass. You can make something lighter if you're willing to throw more money at it to use like neodymium as the magnet material, to an extent, right? But you sort of have to pick two, right? And so these days, one of the things I see is manufacturers trying new strategies, new transducer designs, in an attempt to squeeze every last drip of juice out of that orange, right? And try to get systems that are just a bit better than they were last year and a bit better than they were the year before that. And eventually you will probably run out of juice in that orange to squeeze, but I don't think we're quite there yet. I'm also seeing a different trend. And this one actually is sort of split two ways. On one hand, for a lot of consumer audio, you're seeing things like soundbars. You know, Sonos has soundbars. Our soundbars are generally pretty good. But you're also seeing things where you're trying to, a lot of consumers want to go back to like a whole bunch of speakers all around them. And the hard part there is if you go back to a whole bunch of speakers all around you, you end up spending a lot of money and having to run cables and stuff. And it's just not a great consumer experience. And so the trick becomes one of how do we build sort of all-in-one devices that throw sound in ways that it makes it seem like you're getting sound from places where there isn't actually physically a speaker. That's certainly something that I see us doing. That's something that I see other companies working on. You do that through all sorts of different tricks. You bounce sounds off the wall. You know, that's the biggest single thing you do. But then you also use like head-related transfer function stuff to try to make people think, you know, that sound is coming behind me or above my head. And none of these things work perfectly alone in isolation, because most people's living rooms are not an anechoic chamber. They're not like a perfect space. But these things do start to work really well when you mix them together and when you do it tastefully. You know, there's some products on the market that I've heard where it's like, yeah, that's really cool, but I can hear the math, you know, and you don't want to hear the math. I want to hear something that is a convincing, you know, convincingly sound is coming from over there, even though the speaker isn't there. But not sound is coming from over there, even though the speaker isn't there. And also, what's that weird, like, distorted, garbly sound in the background, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Remember when they used to just add reverb to it and they called it 5.1? Like, the first issues of, like, surround sound that was just,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, it was just reverb returns, yeah.
It was just reverb.
I know a theater that just installed more speakers on the sides and the back of the venue and just put the same signal through all of them, and they're like, now we have surround sound. It's like, no, you do not have surround sound.
No, you do not.
Now you have more combs.
Not quite.
Yep.
What's something you don't like about what you do?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to choose one thing, it's that we are often in the speakers we're working on, like, constrained by budget, right? We can't make speakers that cost too much money, otherwise people won't buy them. And we're not aiming at the very top end of the market, right? We try to make good choices, really sound choices, to make things that sound as good as we can make them in a reasonable product that a normal person would be able to buy and would want to have, right? But that does mean we don't necessarily get to play with some of the super fancy materials. Like, none of the Sonos products have, like, beryllium diaphragms in them, right? You know, even when you start talking about like fancy enclosure materials, it's like, yeah, they're basically all plastic. And yeah, we're using good plastics and we're using them in ways that make them more recyclable when you go to recycle them at the end of the day. But if it's not injection moldable, maybe it's not going to make its way into the speaker, right?
Yeah. Did you ever have to find a point where you had to wrestle with yourself with just accepting that, like, I can't make this thing as good as it can be or I want it to be, or I can't make a decision because of all those factors you just said?
You know, what I do have around me is a really good support structure. I'm not the only audio systems engineer here, right? You know, there's many folks on my team, which I love because I get to learn from all of them. And that's amazing. That's not something I've really had before. I've had like maybe one person that I'm learning from at the company. And that's the only other engineer, you know, doing the stuff there. Here, I get to learn from like 10, 15, 20 different people all about this stuff. And so when we do run into an issue where we have to make a decision like that, we will make multiple mock-ups. We will tune them so they all sound as good as they can sound. We will sit them in a room. We will have people come through, sometimes a blind listening test, sometimes not, and give their impression on each of them. And it will tell us, hey, does that really matter? Does it matter as much as maybe we think it does? And we can trust that there's a ton of people here who all care about the sound that Sonos makes as well. They all have trained ears. And we can trust that we're making the right decision based on that data.
Samuel, you had something, and we didn't come back to it, I think. We went to Sam's garage and saw a gigantic subwoofer. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, it's consoles now, which is great. So I may be a little bit addicted to collecting ridiculous giant things, and it's possibly a problem. So I have in my garage like a prototype M-Force subwoofer, the power soft thing, which is a lot of fun. It's really cool. It's actually my my normal like live sound sub just because I don't have other live sound subs right now. Maybe I should get a few like medium sized subs instead of one like 30 inch cone thing.
Yeah.
And then
nope.
But hold on, for those who don't know, that's like, it's an actual like piston driving the cone, right?
Yeah, so it's a moving magnet transducer. The transducer alone, without the cone or anything, weighs 40 or 50 pounds.
Lord.
And it has like a moving mass, which matters to people who know what this means, of over a kilogram, which is ridiculous, insane.
That sounds like my pitch.
pretty much. So it's a really cool transducer. They basically stacked all of their eggs in the basket of how much force can we make this make, and then just put a giant cone on it. The spec sheet says it'll push about 1,000 pounds of force, which is ridiculous. And so that in my garage is sitting, you know, behind the table saw, but then also behind now, not one, not two, but three ridiculous audio consoles, two of which I have not taken out of their case in years. And the third one I only took out of its case because I wanted to get it set up and working. Some of these were given to me. Some of these I bought for like pennies on the dollar of what they used to sell for. I am the proud owner of a Midas Heritage 2000, yay, a Midas Heritage 1056 channel frame, and also now a PM1D, which are things that you don't normally find in somebody's garage, especially somebody who doesn't actually do live sound for a living.
I talk about the Midas, but I want to talk about the PM1D for a second. Those like little outboard preamps were pretty cool in their day. And I think the Yamaha signature sound kind of changed when they lost those little outboard pre's. When they went to the 5D and everything was built into the console, it lost a little bit of a luster. Those things were really cool. I actually dug those. The work surface was horrible. But
I disagree. The PM1D work surface was actually really good.
Meh.
Oh, I've started a war.
From a modern engineer standpoint, that work surface and the matrixing that you had on there was actually really good.
I'd say matrixing. I mean, you don't touch matrixing. You touch channels. Like,
all right.
Not really. Okay. Set it and forget it, dude. It's like Ronco.
We worked on different types of shows.
Yeah, true. Yeah, you're a monitor. You're at the other end of the snake. Sorry.
You know, for what it's worth, I don't have an opinion on it yet, other than it's probably the coolest, largest, heaviest piece of equipment that I own. Well, heaviest if you count all of the extra boxes that go with it, because, like, I think the Heritage 2000 is, like, 850 pounds in its case. This is, like, 500 pounds for the surface.
You and Billy LaGuardia should get together. And
we really should.
I'm just saying, Wayne will give you a run for your money. That I call his Paragon the boat, and it's 1,100 pounds in the case with the cable.
Yeah, man.
Yep. I believe it. But like, what's interesting about those Yamaha pre's, at least in this, at the time, I suppose, because this thing was designed in the late 90s, it came out in like the 99, early 2000s. They either didn't have or decided not to use like what we would consider today to be like really top tier analog to digital converters. Like the converters they have respectable specs, but compared to basically anything that you would put in a modern, even an inexpensive mixing console, they're not great. But what they did is they decided to take two converters for every channel and sort of stack them on top of each other. And I think, but I'm not sure, almost the same way that like sound devices in Zoom are stacking things to make like 32-bit audio these days. They claimed that the inputs on that console had the equivalent of 28-bit bit depth, and the outputs had 27-bit depth. I don't know exactly how that math worked out. I've never spoken with a Yamaha engineer who worked on it, but I think that is probably at least part of what made that special, because I don't think they ever did that again.
I'm going to hazard a guess, man. I read Douglas Self's book, and he talks a lot about doing the analog version of that, which is you just run two op amps in series, and then you sum them at the end, and it's basically like doing averaging on a measurement in Smart. Right?
You
like,
run them in parallel, I think.
Then you get... I was picturing it in my head. I don't know why I said series. Yeah, well,
no worries.
The signal is...
You get either 3 or 6 dB better noise floor, and I think that may also be what they're doing there. That would make it way easier than trying to combine like a low side and a high side together and not like get clipping to be annoying.
Although that's how Halo 3 did its HDR lighting, in case anybody cares, on the Xbox. Ooh. They rendered each frame twice, and they did the low brightnesses and then the high brightnesses, and then they add them together. And that's why the resolution was so crappy on the Xbox. See? You didn't think we were going to end up there tonight.
No, I didn't.
All right, Sam, hit it.
All right, Sam. So what do you wish you knew when you first started?
You know, of course I wish I knew everything I know now when I first started, but if there's like one thing that I wish I could go back and tell myself, it's probably that, like, I figured this out over time, but I did not need to know everything up front to get a job in designing speakers. Like, I had the worst imposter syndrome when I first started designing speakers. Once I was not a cop. When I was a cop, it was forgivable. But once I was at community, I was like, I don't think I know what I'm doing at all, you know, and eventually I learned, and I learned from people who had done this for years. And it's not like I needed to hide that I didn't know things. Like, they hired me because they wanted help doing this, and they were willing to teach me, you know, they were essentially willing to pay me to learn how to design speakers. And at the end of the day, it would have made, like, my mental health certainly better if I had been like, well, actually, yeah, no, it's fine that I don't know what I'm doing with this part. Like, clearly they still like me. Clearly I'm bringing value here. And eventually I'll figure it out.
Is it my turn?
Yep.
Okay. Actually, I know the answer to this because we've done it, but I would just, hypothetically speaking, God, come down and we're going to visit you in Boston. And you're going to take us out to eat. Where are we going?
Ooh.
Please don't mind.
There's a few options. I mean, depends on if we're by my house or by the office. There's a couple of really good Asian places by the office because we're right next to Chinatown. I would probably take you to one. I'm going to butcher this name terribly, called Itarashi Sushi Teriyaki.
Yum.
Which is like little hole in the wall place. Surprisingly good sushi, really great teriyaki, which is what I get there, for really not that much money considering you're in the center of Boston.
Is that the place? I think I've been there with you.
Yes, you've been there with me.
Sweet.
Michael, what was
and
the spot
Sam
you
was
thought
too.
He was
I was
going to
say,
you.
I think I was there. That was really good.
Yeah, Sam and I went there with you, and also I think when Hannah and I came
Hannah
to see
there.
Kyle's show, yeah, we went there.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, there was a group of us at one point, yeah.
And then when my dad and I came down to see you, Sam, you took us to this, it was like a little Italian kind of grill spot. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I just had dinner there tonight, actually.
Yum.
That place is called Mast, I want to say, with like an apostrophe at the end for no reason.
That makes it hip and cool. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Man, right, Sam, we're going to have to hang out. I want to ride this couch.
Well, the couch lives at RIT with the robotics club that we built it with, but you know,
we can get the keys.
Make your own.
Yeah, we can get the keys. Get the keys.
We can swing that.
Just drive around the block.
How fast does it go?
Yeah, it went about 7 miles an hour, but you had to be really careful because if you stopped too quick, it would flip forward.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, as I would expect. Yeah, I mean that's part of the fun.
It's a couch.
Yeah. It's a couch.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right, Chris.
All right. Well, if you could define your legacy or how you'd want to be known aside from lasers and robotic couches, or maybe that's what you want to be known by, how would you define that?
I mean, I want to be known as somebody who, like, not only did cool stuff in the industry, but also taught people about it. You know, I love mentoring folks and I love teaching classes about this stuff. Like, I love sharing what I learn. And to me, if I can end up in a position one day where people think of me like they've thought of these other folks who have written books or have given lectures, you know, that's the sort of thing that I would love to see.
It's awesome.
Back it.
Yeah.
Aww.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for hanging out.
Of course.